Madeline is 13. She's lived in a lab her whole life. She's got a disease where the slightest infection could kill her. And every night, she dreams. She dreams of the king of germs visiting her, trying to dance with her, touch her, destroy her. But with the help of a friend, an imaginary friend, Madeline plans her escape. Madeline's the central character in a play being read this month in a production of by Kansas City's newest theater. Why does Kansas City need another theater? I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we're meeting the KC Public Theater and hearing about this play, one of the first things it's putting before an audience. Joining me is Elizabeth Bettendorf-Bowman. She's executive artistic director of the new operation. And Elizabeth, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you here. And you're also directing a staged reading of Her Own Devices. That's the play that will be next week at the Uptown Arts Bar. The playwright is Kansas City's Lindsay Adams, and she's joining us today as well. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
So, Elizabeth, let me start with you. Kansas City already has a pretty rich and vibrant theater scene, many would say. Why do we need another?
Well, what makes our theater different is that we work to provide free access to theater. And a part of being accessible is also not necessarily producing plays in the typical theater spaces. We go around town, we're on street corners, we're in bars. So we come to you.
And I know this staged reading will be in a bar next week. We'll talk about that. But I guess I wonder how you got into this. Why is this something that that became important to you? You've worked in theater, right?
Yes, I've worked in theater. Theater's been a part of my life forever. My mother's a theater teacher. I'm a theater teacher. And so I think something that I really noticed that I loved was teaching theater appreciation classes to non-majors. And so there's almost a salesman quality about it. You have to sell theater to people and tell them why they should like it too. And so that's a part of it. There's so many people who have never seen a play. They've never been in a play outside of being, you know, fifth grade. So,
right.
Yeah.
How did you get this project started? I mean, I know you've worked in local theater. In fact, I know you were just one of the directors, an assistant director in the Rep's most recent play, the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. What would lead you to say, you know, I want to be in charge of something now?
Well, I'm not really. That's been asked frequently, and I'm not really sure. I think it's just something that I innately wanted. I think that's something that a lot of artists want, is to have control over their art. That's what led me to directing, because as an actor, you do get so much creative control, but ultimately, you have to listen to your director. And so, and then, you know, a step above that is being an artistic director and being able to have your hand in an entire season, an entire message that you want to send to the community.
Now, I do want to talk about kind of the season and what's coming up, but let me turn to Lindsay Adams. Your play, Her Own Devices, will be staged by the KC Public Theater, staged in a staged reading next week. Maybe for our listeners, what is a staged reading?
Yeah, well, essentially a staged reading is really whatever Elizabeth and I decide we want it to be.
Well, then by all means, tell us what you want it to be.
Well, for me, stage readings tend to be a little bit different, because a lot of times a staged reading is just an actor, you know, at a stand, and we've got the script on the stand, and they sit there and they read the lines. I've had more non-traditional staged readings because a lot of my plays involve movement, and they involve a lot of storytelling through movement. So for Madeline specifically in this play, the world of her dreams, the world of her nightmares is all told through movement and dance. So I feel like you might be getting a little bit more action going on in this stage reading specifically.
So it will not be people sitting on stools at music stands just reading.
There will be some of that, I'm sure, but there will probably be a little bit more non-traditional movement and staging of place in the stage reading.
You heard me describe the play a little bit at the beginning of the hour. How do you describe this play? What's it about?
For me, it's about the human spirit, and it's about the strength of the human spirit, even in the most untenable of circumstances. So for me, I actually am also a teacher. I do theater education as well with some of the theaters in town. And I'm always amazed and inspired by children, by the strength of their imagination, by the strength of what they believe in. So I've always been drawn to child protagonists. It's something that I've done like 3 plays now with it. So I accept it. It's part of my shtick now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it that
and,
I really
and
love.
And how does that affect what you write? I mean, I my producer's notes about your play included that it has a bizarre nightmare samba with the King of Germs set to Elvis, which
yeah.
I believe is the first time I've ever said that sentence on the radio. Is that something that could only come from the mind of a child?
I think so, because the stakes are so high for children. You know, because everything is so high stakes because they haven't realized how low stakes certain things in life are yet. You know, it's like so many things are new that they're trying to experience them and understand them for the first time. So that's an incredibly high stakes thing. As well as the fact that I swear some of the scariest things I've ever heard have been told to me by my 3-year-old nephew. Like it's absolutely terrifying the kind of nightmares they have. And the fact that children have those, live with them on a day-to-day basis, and just keep going shows just how insanely tough we all were as children to
yeah.
make it to this place.
I'm curious what it's like for you as a playwright working with a theater that is just getting started the way the KC Public is.
Yeah, it's really exciting because in some ways, like, you're connected at that point. Like you think of playwrights, you know, who are connected with certain theaters, which happens. And it's really exciting to be part of a fledgling theater company as it's getting started, because you're sort of part of building that legacy and building that tradition with the company itself, which is a really exciting place to be. You hope that it helps set and move forward the company and the kinds of plays they're doing. I'm excited that Elizabeth and the Kansas City Public Theater is doing very, very new contemporary work, helping playwrights with development. That's all really exciting. And doing this very non-traditional play that involves movement and dance and robots and things of this nature.
Let me ask you, Elizabeth, I mean, what are the first steps of starting a new theater company? Is there a book out there, Starting a Theater for Dummies? How does
this
work?
There actually is a book, and I read it.
Oh, well, I'm glad to know. I just pulled that out of the air.
I think it is called Starting a Theater, but I think they left the dummies out.
But you read it. What do you do first? I mean, you obviously need to get some funding, right?
Yeah, definitely. In our case, we dreamed it first. I think we dreamt it for a good 10 years and had different ideas. And, you know, we'd be walking down the street and say, oh, in our theater, we're going to do this. Or in our theater, we'll never do that, which, of course, I will probably eat my words.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really where it started. And then you just have to do it. You know, we started off, we still have a very low budget, so if you want to donate to us.
Noted. And then your first, this is your first season, but it's not really a fully produced season. What did you do first? What was the first thing you put on a stage?
We're very new, and so our very first stage reading was during our first Mondays at the Arts Bar. It was Dads by Derek Troutwine.
This was just last month.
This
right?
is just last month. And we had just recently learned, I think the first week of January, maybe, that the Arts Bar was going to partner with us for this program. And we reached out to some of our playwright friends like Lindsay and Derek. And Derek said, you know what? I have something I've been working on. Let's see if I can pump it out in the next couple
yeah.
weeks. He's a faculty member at Benedictine College, so he was on winter break, luckily.
And is that's a play that is still in development in some
yes,
sense then?
It is.
Is that one of the unique things that this creates the opportunity for? You can actually take things at sort of that experimental level?
Yeah, definitely. It's a low stakes environment for sure. The people who so far have been coming to the readings have had really great feedback. I know that Derek really appreciated having a talk back at the end with the audience, asking questions, what was clear, what wasn't clear. And there aren't, we have a lot of playwrights in this city that are really wonderful, and not a whole lot of environments where they get this opportunity. And they benefit, and we benefit, because we all love listening to these stories.
Mm-hmm. When you do get to the stage of doing fully produced plays, will they all be by local artists?
I would say area artists, okay, for sure. And we don't...
You're not doing the classics.
You know, we will do some classics in different ways. So in a reimagined way. Like, for example, Tennessee Williams, he's from Missouri. A lot of people forget about that. Lanford Wilson, also from Missouri and Kansas. So we'll also be playing with what more well-known playwrights as well. But we do want to keep it localized to our area. We're not going to produce something that takes place in a New York apartment. A lot of us can't really relate with that.
So you're really thinking about your audience very specifically, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. We are producing for the community, and we want to make sure that we remember what they hold dear. So the themes, the location, things like that.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Lindsay, how this play, Her Own Devices, how it fits into the rest of the work you've done. Is this typical of your other plays, or is it a different direction for you?
I think that it's actually interesting because this was the first full-length play I wrote while in grad school. So I guess this is my juvenile work, if we're using those broad terms.
How long ago that is that we're talking about?
I mean, that's not that long ago. So that's like 3 years ago.
All right. Now that you're a grown-up.
Now that I'm adult and my writing style is so adult now, I think it's been interesting looking back and seeing how many connections there are, even with plays that sort of on their face look very, very different. So I found that most of my plays are about either the future or the past. And it's usually me dealing with some sort of issue, something that matters to me right here, right now. But through that lens, I love genre, and I think we don't do genre enough in theater specifically. So I love science fiction. I love folk tales. I love horror. Coming up, a horror play by Lindsay Adams. So I feel like that's something that very much inspires me. And I sort of take pieces and then usually play around with them or deconstruct them or add a little bit of playfulness and a little bit of magic, because magic is really important to me.
And this play this one's been around for a while, so it's not at an experimental stage in the way that maybe the last production of Casey Public was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely not quite at that place, although let me tell you, the process of a play being brought to life is a longer one than many know.
So it still could change as a result of what happens at this staged reading.
Oh, absolutely. I've had several staged readings of this, and I've actually have done a pretty substantial rewrite that I have never heard before. So this will be my first time hearing it in front of an audience and seeing how they respond to those new pages, how those change, how we view, you know, different characters in the play. So it's still very much being shaped. It's just sort of in its final stage, I feel like.
I'm curious, Elizabeth, what it's been like as you have entered this arena. You know the other folks in the theater scene in town. How have they responded to the entrance of a new player?
You know, they've all been really excited. We've had several artistic directors, executive directors, personally reach out to us and tell us how exciting it is and how they're excited to have a theater that has a new type of mission. Our mission's not necessarily traditional.
You don't feel like you're competing with them?
No, not at all. In fact, I would say that what we want to do is to send more people to the larger theaters.
Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to imagine what the business plan, if you will, is of a theater that plans to offer its work for free.
You know, we view ourselves a lot like the public library. That's kind of why we're named Kansas City Public Theater.
But the public library gets tax support.
But churches also are ran like charities. That's basically our business plan. It is actually our business plan.
Yeah.
We run ourselves like a charity.
Is there something that is actually – do you find that there are audience members who would rather see, I guess I'd call it a scaled-down kind of production. Right now it's the staged readings. Later on it will be fully produced plays, but I assume it will never be something like you would go to the music hall and see from a theater league or something that the KC Rep might put on. It's a different kind of production, right?
Yeah, it's much different. I think it's going to be different not only in the scale, but in location as well. And so I think that our audience finds that exciting.
What will be the location for the state for the fully produced shows?
Well, our next fully produced show is going to be an adaptation of Medea, the Greek tragedy Medea. It's called Medea, an American Tragedy, and we are going to produce that through Kansas City Fringe Festival this summer in July. So we are not quite sure of what the location is, but usually the locations are like just off Broadway, Arts Asylum. But we are also planning on having free performances throughout the city that are in non-traditional places. Mm-hmm. So everybody has access to
it. Give me some examples of the non-traditional places. I know you're doing this series of readings at a bar, but where else?
Community centers. We are working with the city to find community centers that will be available during the time we're looking at. We're even looking at street corners, empty lots.
Wow.
I'm telling you.
It'll be exciting.
Yeah.
You mentioned this production of Medea that's coming up. It'll be part of the Fringe Festival to begin. You mentioned that you're trying to do things that are Midwest themed or sensitive to the setting of the Kansas City. I don't think of that particular Greek tragedy as that, but are you doing something different?
Yeah, it's definitely it's a modern retelling of the story. So Greek tragedies are very universal. That's why we still do them. So at its core, what the story is, it's a story about a woman who is an immigrant to the United States, and she gave her whole self to her country. But she finds that it keeps taking and taking, and so finally she needs to take herself back.
Wow, so that does feel like a very current topic.
Yes, most definitely.
The idea of the KC Public Theater, you said, is to be accessible, but it sounds like maybe you're also trying to say something with the productions you choose.
Most definitely. I think that's a very common thing with, you know, most artistic directors are going to try to have a message. I think that our message is one of acceptance and of love. So that's what, I guess that's what all of our themes are. We want to know people and we want to accept people and understand their stories.
Yeah, and I think an important part of, you know, like bringing theater to the public, for the public, is also treating people on stage that we don't always see. Mm-hmm. So Madeline specifically is someone living with a disability, and we do not see enough of those people on stage ever. And it means something not just to bring these stories to the public, but to also help show the public a broader view of them and give them, you know, the ability to see themselves on stages in ways that perhaps we haven't been doing up to now. Mm-hmm. And I think we can forget that, like, going to a theater can actually be really intimidating for lots of people who haven't grown up with it. You know, like, it's this big, fancy building. You're supposed to dress up for it, or are you not? It's a matinee. Does that make a difference? Like, there's this entire process that has been sort of built into our lives, and I feel like we've been really blessed because of that, but that many people don't have, and like expecting them to walk in day one and be comfortable and understand, you know, like all of the different small rules of this place is insane.
These are questions I have when I go to the theater. I understand. So, Lindsay, let me ask you, what's next for you after this play goes up? We do the reading. What's your next project?
Yeah, so I'm actually in the midst of writing a new play. I actually just finished my thesis production for my MFA. So I just have to write my comprehensives and then be done. So that's exciting. And I'm starting on a new play that is actually set in southern Missouri. So
okay.
Set close by that. I don't know if you read the New York Times article about the mothers and family members of people who have been accused of sexual harassment. There was a big article, and I'm sort of drawing off that. I'm really interested in that. So it's going to be a play about mothers and sisters who go to a support group whose sons or brothers have been accused of sexual assault.
Wow.
And sort of unpacking what that is, how you deal with someone you love being accused of something so terrible, as well as how often other women protect perhaps the people that they shouldn't be.
Sounds like a story that maybe one day will be told in a particular new theater here in Kansas City. Elizabeth Bettendorf-Bowman is Executive Artistic Director of the new KC Public Theater. Lindsay Adams is the playwright behind Her Own Devices, which will have a staged reading on Monday, March 5th at the Uptown Arts Bar. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up, we meet a local poet who has turned to the visual arts and to creating spaces for the Metro's African-American or marginalized artists to show their work. You might be surprised at the places she's found and why when KCUR's Central Standard returns. Stay with us. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. Where in Kansas City does an artist go to display and sell their art? There are all sorts of galleries and shops, public and private spaces. But if you're an African American whose art has a Black aesthetic, a lot of artists will tell you the options are few and far between. One well-known local artist wanted to do something about that, although her own art is not usually made of paint or clay, but of words. Natasha Elskari has joined us on KCUR before. She shared poetry and spoken word art, but today she's joining us to talk about a new project, Lifting Up the Work of Others, the kind of work that often hangs on a wall. Natasha, welcome back.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a very busy weekend coming up.
I do.
With two different projects kicking off, and we're going to talk about both of them. But I want to start with Black Space, Black Art. How do you describe what this project is to people?
I describe Black Space, Black Art as an opportunity and a chance to actually create space for Black artists in the blackest of spaces, which are our barbershops and beauty salons, places where African-Americans frequent either weekly or monthly, definitely at least a couple of times a year, if not for some people every week, people like my mom.
So, sure.
And what I say is that I've gathered together a collection of six artists, three women and three men, because you know, I'm a feminist, and so it's very important to me to have gender balance, and they are across age and across different experiences and spaces within their art. Some of them are very new to art. Some of them are very seasoned. And I go out and talk to barbershops and beauty salons. Some of them are people I already knew. Others are just people that I've watched, and I harass them until they say yes. I also harass the artists until they say yes, and so it... that's what we've done. And so now we're in eight barbershops and beauty salons, and we are actually going to be expanding to another market that is African-American focused as well. So, you know, it's interesting.
You're learning the complexities of the world of curating art, it sounds like.
It is, and in different spaces too, right? So when I came into the studio today, I was looking at all of the ways that you can display art. I love that. And barbershops are different depending on where you are.
Yeah, take us into the typical, if there is a typical, barbershop or beauty shop in the African-American community. I mean, it does not sound at first like a place that naturally suggests, oh, this is an art display area.
Right, but it actually is because the heads are moving canvases and the people who work in those spaces are actually artists. They may consider themselves business owners, but they are transforming people's appearance. And so I consider that moving canvases. They're all culturally, they're similar in that they are filled with rich conversation and honest conversation about Black life, about what is happening for and around Black people. But the actual structures of the building are completely different. You know, I have one of the places has navy blue walls. The other one has bright orange walls. Another one has gray and white walls. So,
and you're not repainting the walls.
No, we are not repainting the walls. And every installation, we come up with creative ways to, you know, maintain the integrity of the wall, but also display the art. And so that is its own artistic project in itself.
I mean, you started this with sort of an assumption or an understanding, an observation that there are only limited spaces in many cases for African-Americans to display art. Why is that?
Well, because I don't think that African-Americans ever how can I say this? I think that everyone has a different aesthetic. And so people are going to actually display the art that appeals to them unless they are very conscious and make a decision to be fully inclusive. Most people are going to have an appeal to the art that appeals to them.
And when you say that, you're sort of saying that they have to sort of make sacrifices to fit into a particular space.
Yes. Or people just don't pursue it because they don't think that art is important.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so if someone else says it's important from a different angle or a certain angle, then it's like, oh, okay, well, then we like this person now. But what if you're not that person? And then the chances, I mean, Kansas City has its beloved artists, you know, its beloved African-American artists. But if you're not one of those people, it really limits where you can share your work. And depending on how you've entered. So if you didn't go to art school or you didn't even go to college, mm-hmm. the chance and opportunity for you to even interact with certain people who do make those decisions about what art is installed in Kansas City, you're not even a part of that conversation.
Yeah. So why would a business owner, a barber, a beauty salon operator want to do this? I mean, I'm not sure. Are they all excited about people traipsing into their businesses just
yes,
to see the
absolutely.
Art?
Absolutely. So that's the part that's so exciting because there is a particular business owner that this appeals to. But business, like I said, they're business owners, but they're also artists. And so they're in these spaces, their businesses sometimes 12 hours a day, mm-hmm. especially on like Friday and Saturday when it's just jumping. And even though these businesses are lucrative, the decor is typically the last thing that they're thinking about. And so the art actually changes the feel of the entire space.
Yeah.
And so they get like decor every 3 months.
And so it's a good for them and good for the artists.
Yes, it's good for the artist. People have access to the art that they've never seen. And so my favorite story is one of a young person who gets their hair cut with their mom went to school and saw one of Harold Smith's pieces in his art classroom, and he said to the teacher, "Hey, I know that guy. His art is at my barber shop." And I was like, "Oh!" So when I got that message, like that just made it worthwhile because now you have African American children who come to understand that yes, you know, Black people do actually do art. I was at one of the barber shops and we were installing. And a young man was sitting in the barber chair, and he looked to be about between 15 and 19. And he was like, "I didn't even know Black men did art." Hmm. And I was like, "How would you? If you don't have an artist in your family, what Black artists are you learning about in your K-12 experience?
Yeah.
How are you interacting with them?" So
you mentioned Harold Smith. He's one of the artists that you're featuring, and he's pretty well known.
He's very well known all
over the world.
All over the world, and very humble about that. but yeah,
who else? Give us a couple other examples of some of the artists.
There's Harold Smith. There's Warren Stiles Harvey. There's Linnell Diggs. There is Adrian Clayton.
All visual artists. Different styles.
Different styles. There's Vivian Wilson Blewett, and there's Nikita Graves.
Are any of these going to be, I guess I'd say, challenging? Is it going to be jarring for the person walking in to get their hair cut to see any of these? Do you think it's going to be something that that makes them comfortable in that space?
I think so. Like, it depends on the shop. So I will ask the shop owner, like, "What's your vibe? You know, what is it like here?" So some people will say, "Hey, bring your political stuff. I'm totally fine with that. We talk about all that stuff here in the barbershop." I have one salon where the owner loves nudes. And so, you know, there are nudes to wear. Of course, all clientele can view that. But yeah, it just really depends. I think that has been the great thing about the owners is that they are open to the expression of the artist. And that was really one of the requirements. Of course, I curate that and make sure it has some balance because I understand also as a patron and as a parent, you know, you want to expose, but you don't want to.
Sure.
You know, you don't want to have to make those kind of decisions for people.
Not overexposed.
But I don't know if you can do that. Young people see so much. Like, I'm not sure if there is a such thing anymore.
That's
a
good point, unfortunately. I do want to mention that the kickoff reception for this project, for at least for Vivian Wilson Blewett's art, is this Sunday, March 4th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Curly Girl Salon and Boutique in Lee's Summit. And
yes.
I gather that's just one of many opportunities.
All six of them are having or have had their receptions, and so which is simultaneously happening with something else that's going on too.
Well, let's talk about that other thing, in fact, because you're actually opening a completely separate new gallery together with one of those artists, actually, Warren Harvey, right?
Yes, yes, we are, and I know it's kind of all just happened really fast, but really not happening fast. There was an opportunity that we were given to do our first full exhibition as a collective, and we did that, and it spawned into another idea and discussion about actually using that space as an art gallery. And so it is a shared space within the Center for Spiritual Living Kansas City, which is a spiritual community.
Yeah, over on 39th Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's my spiritual community, but it's just been kind of nestled in this pocket that believes very strongly in diversity, inclusion, and showing up exactly as you are. And so it just was a perfect match. And this space is like, the space is perfect to display art.
The Black Space Black Art project is obviously geared toward African-American artists. Who is this for? What kind of artists are you trying to feature in this gallery?
Well, obviously we do want to feature African-American artists. In addition to that, we said that we're inclusive of marginalized artists, so I want to talk a little bit about each month we have a different theme. And so this month is Women's History Month, so we're displaying women's art. And I'm so excited because my grandmother is actually in this show. She's 96 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I've always wanted to display her art. And so,
what kind of art does she do?
She does watercolor, oil, pencil or graphite. Needlepoint. She knits. She crochets. She does all those things. But I'll just be focusing on her watercolors and oil.
Wow.
In this show. So really excited about that. So the women are ranging from actually I have a younger cousin who my grandmother taught, and she's 11. So 11 to 96 in this show, all women. You just have to be a woman producing your art. Your art doesn't have to be about women or whatever. It's just produced by women.
Mm-hmm.
We will have in May. We'll have an LGBT month. We have a botanical month.
Really?
Yes, and then we have an abstract month, and we'll have a social justice month. We'll have a Flames of Faith month, the body politic. But the focus is to give some breathing space, over 55 month as well, some breathing space for artists who are typically not shown. So they will receive some, that'll be our first attempt.
Yeah. Is it different curating that kind of group of artists, marginalized people, than it would be if you were running a gallery that was sort of selling high-priced, folks who have been trying to market their art for years? I'm thinking that out of that sort of competitive environment, that's one way of curating exhibition, but you're doing something different.
I am, and I think it is different because one of the things that really just kind of shook my soul was over every time a woman submitted in this particular show, most times they said things like, "Is this okay?"
Huh.
And I was like, wow, not here's my art. It was like, I'm interested. Then I'm like, great, submit. And then they're like, "Is this okay?"
Which implies that maybe they've been told before.
Absolutely. That it isn't. Yeah. And so I don't make a decision about if the art is quote unquote good or not. That's not my job, because somebody's going to love it. You might like your shirt. I may not, but the shirt is here. And so it's for the taking for the people who like it. And so I feel like that's not my job to tell people to wave the magic wand on what's good and what isn't. Instead, it's just to create space and room for voice and different perspectives about life experience and worldview.
Is there a particular artist in addition to your grandmother who comes to mind as sort of really embodying what this current exhibition at the Elskari Harvey Art Gallery is about? Well, you can talk about your grandmother's art too if you want.
Yeah, well, no, I just feel like what's interesting, I noticed overall that there was this heavy use of dark colors. And I was thinking about that in terms of people's perception about women, that, it's pastel and it's pinkish. But these women are using some heavy saturation, heavy color. I noticed that. I am not an art critic. I'm a lover of art. But I feel like, wow, what people think is feminine expression is actually very different than what it is when you leave it to its own volition, when you're not telling women, this is what I want you to create.
Defining it for them.
And so when they are just defining, and then they're like, okay, here's what I've worked on. That is such a different thing versus I want to, you know, if someone is doing something for a show. And I will say that even for my little cousin who is 11, when I asked her to send her work, she sent me the safest work. And I was so disappointed. And I said to her mom, tell her to send me what she loves. Tell her to send me what she loves to draw. And it was very different. So even at 11, she's learning.
Internalizing,
follow these rules.
Yeah.
You know, go safe. And this is what you go hard with, what you're passionate about. You know, as a Black girl, that stays to the, push that away. That's just for you. But when it's time to present, you present the stuff that everybody's going to like.
So that opening reception is also on Sunday for you.
I'm nuts.
From 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's at the Center for Spiritual Living. I do want to ask you, though, Natasha, I mean, come back to where we all started. It seems a little, I don't know, ironic, I guess, that you, as a person who's made your career with the art of words, is now doing something that doesn't involve words at all, at least in these particular art projects.
You think so?
I mean, what is it ironic, or does it fit right in as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, it's not ironic to me because I feel like I just embody the artistic life. Everything to me is creation and from art. You know, my son is a math science business guy, and he thanked me for raising him as an artist child because he said it just changes how I see the world. He's not an artist, but he allows that to push him. I don't think it's a stretch for me because, one, I love to gather, and I'm passionate about access to resources. I'm passionate about voice, and I'm passionate about, you know, giving voice to marginalized groups. That's been my entire career when I was in education as a spoken word artist and a writer, and then now in this position. And so I'm still actually doing them. I'm working on two books as well, and I'm still doing that.
Good. We know you haven't abandoned that.
Yeah, I haven't abandoned that. I'm still working on that. But I don't think it's a stretch. I think it's. I think other people find it a stretch, and they're like, "Who do you think you are?" Well, I'm Natasha, and I just do what I see as a need, and I don't actually ask for permission. When I see there's a need, I'm like, "At what point do we stop complaining about it and we create it for ourselves?" And that's what I think is important.
What would feel like success for you with these projects? What are they already a success just because they're happening, or what do you really want to see happen here?
I would like just to see that the artists are actually gaining confidence and people are purchasing their work. There is nothing greater than watching what happens to an artist when someone they don't know purchases a piece of their art. It is so validating. I know what it's like to sell a book.
Yeah.
You know, I know what it's like to, you know, for people to clap after a performance or to say that touched me. And I want more people to have that experience. You know, I mean, money is a very fluid thing. I would love to make a gazillion dollars. I probably would give away half of it if I did. But that is, I want to see artists feel like their art is something that they can supplement their life with or make a living doing. And I don't care about that conversation about you can't be an artist full time.
Yeah.
I don't even entertain that. I'm like, just make it work. Make it work for your life.
Making the art is not necessarily its own reward. It also should raise some value.
It should raise some value, absolutely. Yeah.
It's Natasha Elskari, as she will hold a reception for artist Vivian Wilson-Blewett's work at the Curly Girl Salon this Sunday, March 5th. That's in the afternoon, but in the morning, from 11 to 2, you can visit the Elskari Harvey Gallery, which is opening at the Center for Spiritual Living in Kansas City on 39th Street. Both those things this Sunday. Natasha, have a wonderful weekend.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Really good to have you here this morning. When we come back, our monthly arts show continues, and we turn from the visual arts to music. This music. It comes from a band that plays all sorts of Afro-Caribbean music and focuses on tunes and beats from Cuba and Haiti, and comes from Puerto Rico and Wichita. I'm Brian Ellison. Meet Kansas City's Mundo Nuevo when KCUR's Central Standard returns. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. It's our monthly arts show, and what you're hearing is the work of a local band, Mundo Nuevo. And their band leader and artistic director, Sean Maherter, is here. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're listening to a piece called Mambo Inns. Let's start right there. What is this?
It's a Mario Bazzo classic. We recorded a couple songs to kind of debut ourselves. It's been a couple years ago now. We're in the process of tracking sessions for our first full-length record, but this is sort of the Latin jazz side of us. We also have another track, Pueblo Latino, that reflects the full-on 11-member, sometimes 12 even, salsa orchestra version of us.
Yeah, so tell me about the band. You're still fairly new. You took a couple years to get together, but you just finished your first season.
Right, yeah. Well, this is sort of a malleable project. We have the full-on dance band, but we also have smaller iterations of the group. We also have a concert season that we do on a seasonal basis, 4 times a year. We're going to be announcing what this year's is next week, as a matter of fact. And that's a chance for us to get into different great Kansas City area listening environments for a specifically listening experience, and to make it thematic, program it to things that have dovetailing interest or emanate from the Caribbean. That's our emphasis. Our singer is from Havana, Cuba, and my co-conspirator on flute, Guy Montes, he's from Port-au-Prince. So those are sort of that's our home base and inspiration.
You yourself are not from Cuba or Haiti. Where are you from?
Yeah, I'm actually from Wichita. I've been living in Lawrence for past couple decades.
Which I don't think of as a hotbed of Afro-Caribbean music, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say hotbed applies. It's not an uncommon question. What's this gringo who has trouble rolling his R's doing in this sort of thing? But,
well, and what's the answer to that question?
Back when I moved to Lawrence for school, I was a jazz studies guy, and so my mind was open to all kinds of music, stuff that's usually rhythmically oriented, imported from West Africa, really. And I simply ended up, meeting people who were in salsa bands and going to salsa dance nights. And next thing you know, I'm doing some traveling and found myself going back to parts of Central and South America. And, eventually got to the point after working with some of the people that are now in the band, saying, why don't we do a salsa thing of our own? Mm-hmm. And so eventually, when it did meet the singer, Ramon Tirada, it was like, well, we got all the pieces in place, and that's what we've developed.
That's how it started to come together. You said you've developed a focus particularly on music from Cuba and Haiti. How did that come to be? You mentioned there's particular members of the band from those places.
Right. And, it's something that we aspire to try to find connections in. These two countries are referenced as being source material for so much what has informed Western music. And while they have a lot of overlap, they are distinctive, I talked to Ramon and Guy about life growing up, the food and customs. There's a lot of things that are similar. There are things that are interchangeable musically, and it hasn't been done a whole lot. So we not only want to cover material that comes from these places, but we're looking to try to make arrangements and new material that conjoins the two, not unlike what's happened with, say, bossa nova was a combination of samba and jazz music, or mm-hmm. classical music, and milonga helped contribute tango. So, we're looking to try to see where we can find commonalities between these two places.
I want to listen to a little more of your music. This is, I think, the full orchestra performing a song called Pueblo Latino. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Right. So this is the lead track from that. It simply shows what the larger dance club version of us sounds like.
Let's listen to a little bit of Pueblo Latino from Mundo Nuevo.
De cualquier barrio,
de cualquier ciudad,
tu hora
So we're listening to music from Mundo Nuevo and talking with their band leader, Sean Maherter. Sean, how many people are making the music that we're hearing right there?
That is 11 people. Yeah, and
sounds like there's at least 11 instruments and voices represented there, so some people must be doing double duty.
Well, it's a full horn section. There's people singing along with while playing. There's a, you know, three percussionists, the Ramos brothers from Topeka. They're immigrants from Ponce, Puerto Rico.
All three of them? Three brothers,
yeah,
in the band?
Yeah, you know, when I met them, I initially was going to undertake this with some other drummers, and I met one of them via Ramon, and he's like, yeah, I've got these two other brothers, and we've been playing together forever. I was like, well, how's it getting any tighter than that? If you're willing to go in on this with me, I would love to have you. So
you think you can hear their closeness in their rhythms as well as in their
absolutely
in their voices?
The time, you know, keeping good time has never been an issue, and these guys know the material like the back of their hands, so it's great.
I have to think that leading a band of 11 members who are they are not full time. You all have other lives, right?
Right.
Must be quite just in a big administrative task.
Well, it is a mixed bag. Yeah, it's like herding cats, and you know, I gotta stay. I've learned how to. I don't know. Sometimes I probably come off as paranoid, but it does take a lot of administrative detail to keep everybody in line and a lot of schedules. There are some people that don't do music full time. There's other people like our keyboardist Paul Roberts, who is one of the most in demand pianist in town and also does arrangements for the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. I've got to try to schedule things far in advance to make sure all these talented people are able to get in the same room at the same time. So,
I know that you do these performances around town. Various portions of the group do some of these performances, but you're also interested in having some sort of impact beyond Kansas City. I understand you've partnered with a charity. Tell us about that.
Right. It's called the Global Birthing Home Foundation, found at globalbirthinghomefoundation.org, and they are the fundraising arm of a place called Maison de la Naissance, which means birth house. It's a maternal care center down in Torbeck, Haiti. It was founded a couple decades back by a doctor, obstetrician here in Kansas City area, partnered with another doctor. And they found this need for mothers who, you know, frankly, I mean, it's the poorest country in the Western world, and there's a lot of people that don't have good healthcare access. And so, you know, the idea is to bring midwifery to people, to women in need down there. And so I now, as well as my flute friend Guy that I mentioned to you, sit on the board, and you know, we figure that it's a good partnership because we're obviously both interested in the same place, and so we do you know, we help out in the fundraising efforts, try to put on some house mm-hmm. concerts. Mm-hmm. One of our shows later in the year is going to be focusing in on popular music for Haiti, and all the ticket sale proceeds will go towards Global Birthing Home Foundation.
Well, you mentioned the concert season that's coming up. Mm-hmm. I think you said you're going to be announcing that season soon. Does that mean you're not able to give us a sneak preview?
Next week, the whole year is being drawn out. But I can tell you the first Tuesday of next month, we're going to debut at the Westport Coffee House, a program of Latin jazz music. And we're going to be collaborating with John Cazillermute, who's an amazing drummer in the area who has a lot of experience in this stuff as well. And you know, it's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. You know, check us out if you want to find out what's going on.
That's Sean Maherter. He's artistic director and the band leader of the group Mundo Nuevo, a salsa band and a specialist in all sorts of music from Cuba and Haiti and around the New World. Thanks so much, Sean, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If you want to listen back to this show, including our earlier conversations about the KC Public Theater and the recent work of Natasha Elskari curating art, you can find all of that from today's Whirlwind Arts Show and our other shows too at kcur.org. Join us again on Monday for a portrait session with Kansas City author Candace Millard. Central Standards produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. Linda Scherer runs the board, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Brian Ellison. Good to be with you today. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, coming up next.